Hey, Larry, is it hot down there?
No, not at all. We're having monsoon weather, which brings afternoon showers, and it's in the low to mid 80s.
Wow. And even with the showers, I'm assuming the humidity's still low, right?
Well, it kicks up during the shower activity, but it doesn't take long to dissipate.
Yeah, it doesn't get stuck like it does down here.
It doesn't steam off and linger the way it does in the Georgia and Alabama. And although I would call you subtropical climate, that might be a good description of how bad and sticky it is in your neck of the woods.
Do you have anything equivalent to the bug line? The gnat line is what it's called, not the bug line. The gnat line.
What is that?
If you are below a certain level of the state, the gnats, I mean, it's just, you know, you're picking them out of your teeth and out of your hair and everywhere. It's just, it's really awful. It's terrible.
Not a big, tremendous problem here.
Okay. Yeah. It's awful. So somewhere around, it's below McDonough. Maybe it's below Forsyth. I think it keeps moving south. So it used to be, if you were below Macon, you would get it, but I think it's below, I think it's even at Macon now. It's moving. It's awful.
So,
anyway,
yeah, we don't have all the insect problems so as bad as we're at a higher altitude, and there's plenty of insects, but it's just not the same type.
Yeah, you end up with like scorpions and rattlesnakes.
Yeah, they're scorpions are lovely.
Have you ever encountered one like randomly?
Call.
That would be frightening. All right. Well, please consider making us part of your podcast diet. You can search for us at Registry Matters on your smart speaker or podcast app of choice like Google Podcasts or Apple Podcasts. Also, it would be forever helpful for us if you would write a review at any of the podcast app places, iTunes or Stitcher, to help people discover us, and that way we can grow our listenership. And as always, and most appreciated, is the show is supported by our patrons. You guys and gals are amazing. You rock. If you'd like your own exclusive Registry Matters blue ball, consider becoming a patron to our show to support the work that we do here. This week, I'd like to thank a new patron that wishes to remain anonymous. She comes in at the hustler level, which is the $5 or more level. It's very exciting. And to you, send me an a message over Twitter or wherever you can, or through Patreon, and I will, so I can get your address so I can send you your exclusive Registry Matters blue ball.
Well, if she wants to remain anonymous, it probably means that she won't send you any information to get her blue ball.
That is possible. So that's your decision if you would want one, because they're amazing. They're the best. But if you choose to forego that, that's your privilege. Well, this first article comes from WBUR.org. I think that's an NPR station up in Massachusetts. And it says, to reclassify sex offenders, Massachusetts SJC Supreme Judicial Court says sex offender registry board has burden of proof. Tell me what that, what is burden of proof? So they have to prove that you need to be on the registry?
Well, they have a level system in Massachusetts, and the burden of establishing that level is with the government, where it properly belongs. That's the most effective part of the process for the state to have removal processes. They place the burden on the offender. Well, the Supreme Judicial Court, which is our state's highest court, says the registry burden, the registry board bears the burden when determining the sex offender should be removed to a less dangerous classification, which gets you off the internet. And that's just phenomenal news. Those placed in the more serious level 2 and level 3 are subject to having their names and pictures posted online, and those at the lower level are not. And if the state wants to do that, if they want to display your information publicly, they bear the burden of proving. And I encourage everyone who wants to look at like the registry of where there's a petition process. Colorado would be an example, which we're going to be talking about on Darceland Action Wednesday night. The burden is on the registrant when they petition to be removed. The burden should be the other way around. It should be presumptive that the person should be getting off, or there should be presumption that they're at the lowest level of risk if they have that model where they put people on the internet based on risk. And the state who wants to display them or keep them on the registry should bear the burden. And the Supreme Court of Massachusetts got that right. And one of our podcast listeners submitted that for wanting an explanation. And that's why I wanted to talk about this, because it's so important that the state bears the burden. And then the question is, what standard of burden? Is it by clear and convincing, or is it by a preponderance? And in this case, it's clear and convincing. I do believe that they bear the burden.
Yeah, it does say that in the article. Therefore, the ultimate burden of proof should remain with the board to provide by clear and convincing evidence that the classification is current and correct. So clear and convincing, that's lower than beyond a reasonable doubt, right?
That is, but it's the highest level in a civil proceeding, which is what this is.
Okay.
So it's the beyond reasonable doubt only applies in a criminal case. And this is the highest burden that can be established for a civil proceeding. And then our listener wanted to know what the duty to production is. So that means that the offender in a civil proceeding, in a criminal proceeding, the accused doesn't have a duty to produce anything. They can remain silent and tell the state to you do what you got to do. But in a civil proceeding, you bear burden of producing. And so the Supreme Court reminded the registrant, now you're part of this process and you have a burden to produce. If you've got information that shows that you should be classified at a lower level, then you have the burden to produce that. I mean, I think that's a reasonable standard of to take. If you, for example, if they had you to level 3, and you believe that you have progressed through treatment and whatever through the years that you should no longer be at level 3, how would the state be able to evaluate evidence that you refuse to produce to them? So I think it would be fair to say that you have the burden of production. So the court said that in the opinion.
And just to give the inverse, you take a state, I think like mine, where you would have to go in there and you're trying to get off. You have to bring in maybe like a psychosexual eval. You have to bring in possibly like your handlers. You have to get them to testify for you, all to get enough things in front of the judge to get them to take you off. Is that sort of an inverse example of the wrong way to do it, so to speak?
Well, I haven't studied the Georgia recently. I know a lot of people are getting off in Georgia, so it's not as bad as
I just mean that as like in a abstract, just kind of an example where this in Boston and Massachusetts seems like it's something that happens unless somebody puts forth the effort to stop it, instead of going the other way where you have to bring forth saying, "Hey, I would like to have these things happen. Here's my proof of why," and then then the state's trying to keep you on. This is going the other direction.
Well, I think in this case, it's the person who wanted to the lower level was asking for the reclassification. Georgia doesn't really have a reclassification.
No.
You serve out your time or you get off if you're eligible. But I do believe Georgia places the burden on the offender, and you're correct. This is correct. The way Massachusetts, the burden is on the state rather than the individual. And that's the way it should be, in my opinion. So it is kind of the inverse of what Georgia has.
Or other states where you have to go forth and I guess the inverse would be what we're also going to talk about, a civil commitment, where you have no ability to bring forth any evidence to get yourself out of that situation.
It's not quite that bad in the case we're going to talk about, but yes, it's bad. Those liberals up in the Massachusetts Supreme Court appear to have gotten this one correct. We appreciate the listener bringing it to our attention.
Absolutely. Thank you, Hank, for that. And so here we go. I posted, so this comes from I posted a part of our show last week, and someone brought up a question that I wanted to throw your way. So here's a clip from what we did last week. One question I did have for you, though, is do you have a fundamental right to be with your spouse and your children?
Well, it seems like if you have the fundamental right to marriage,
do you?
It would seem like, yes, we've got court decisions that says you can marry whoever you want to. You may not be able to sponsor them for admission into the United States if they're not a citizen, but you can marry them. And And I would think that your children are, I mean, I can't cite to the case, but I would think your children are a basic right unless there's some extraordinary circumstances where the state has to take custody of the children.
And then somebody writes me and says that they said that the AWA removes that fundamental right. And I've asked the person for specific language and I haven't heard back, but I wanted to get your take. I completely understand where you're coming from, where you say you have a fundamental right to marriage. I mean, that was decided by the Supreme Court here recently. And then you extend that to your children. But this person says the AWA gives them the right to just remove your parental access.
I would like for that person to cite to the AWA, more specifically the section that they're referring to, because I'm not aware of it. I consider myself reasonably versed in the Adam Walsh Act. For those who are wondering why we're throwing that jargon around, I don't recall anything about children and parents being. If he's talking about the sponsoring someone where you may have had a child outside the United States and you can't get the child into the United States because you can't get your spouse. I mean, that's not the same issue. But I need more clarity in terms of what that person is referring to, because I'm not aware of anything that says that in the Adam Walsh Act. Now, people under supervision often have interruptions with their relationships, which is tragic, but that's a separate issue. Your supervising conditions are not a part of the Adam Walsh Act.
Right. Anyway, I didn't ask you that last week, I don't think. And, I hadn't heard of it presented that way. I know that they make restrictions on you where you can't be around anyone under the age of 18, including your own children. But there is, it shouldn't be that way, but there's an appeal process there. And that's what this guy in Ohio is doing. And you had said that there should be more of like a group, I don't want to call it a class action, but there should be a group action to get that stricken, unless you have specifics where maybe it was your child that is the victim, where you wouldn't be allowed to have access to your kid.
Yeah, those are conditions of supervision. That's what we're talking about with that person. But the Adam Walsh Act doesn't deal with supervision. It deals with registration, which is a civil regulatory scheme, and it doesn't have any relationship to conditions of supervision, which they have broadly more powers to impose conditions of supervision.
Right.
What I was talking about last week was when they just arbitrarily have a blanket provision that they apply to everyone and say you can't have any contact with your children until your therapist. Well, who's the hell to say that you ever needed any therapy?
Yeah.
I mean, you may have had what was a completely normal relationship, except for the person may have been below the age. And therapy won't fix that. What therapy will fix that? That's just a choice you have to make to contain yourself. But I'm not aware of any therapy that will stop you from being attracted to people physically. So if you have children that they have that blanket condition that you can't have contact, that I think if those are just written in standard conditions of supervision for those who have a sexual offense, I think those are highly vulnerable.
And that goes, to take another tangent, that goes to the plethysmograph where they hook up the little doodad to your doodad and then they show you pictures. And if you get aroused by it, that doesn't mean you've committed a crime. That just means that arouses you. You could be looking at literally beavers making a dam and you're aroused by that. That doesn't mean you're actually going to go act on it. Just means that arouses you.
Thankfully, that tool is not used very often, but it is a very invasive, a very horrible thing to use. The ABLE assessments is very, very similar with what they measure your response times, looking at photographs. And
right.
The response times are supposedly indicative of how much interest you have in that particular area.
I think they also track eye movement, too, in that.
I'm not sure about that. I've not had the pleasure of taking one of those. But,
you should sign up for that. You should go down.
So, but I'm sure we've got some podcast listeners that I would welcome their feedback on,
absolutely,
on either of those two tests, because I've not had the pleasure of taking either of them and I'm not going to sign up for either of them if I can help it.
I would tell you if you are in that condition that you would even be welcome to come on the show and we could talk about it.
Well, would we be able to keep their identity anonymous so
certainly
that they would not feel the embarrassment?
Certainly.
Well, so seriously, if anyone has taken particularly, pronounce it for me. I stutter on that one.
Plethysmograph.
I can't do it.
I don't blame
that
you.
One.
Yes. If you've taken the test where they hook up the doodad to your doodad, then yeah, feel free to write me and we'll see about hooking you up on the show. But then there is the other one where they are, you know, you're looking at pictures on a screen and they're checking how twitchy you get with the mouse or where your eyes are moving and how long you stay. That is just, I mean, that is It seems to be. It would be very similar to a polygraph as far as they're reading signals, and you see some atrocious image and you don't click off of it fast enough. And you're just like, holy crap, that's the worst thing I've ever seen. And you sit there for a second trying to figure out what it is. Does that mean you're interested in it?
Well, I have not taken one, but that able assessment is much more widely used than the graph.
Yes, the plethysma graph. Yeah, it took me a long time. The first time I looked at it, I was like, I don't know what that is. And my attorney told me what it was. And I was like, seriously? I mean, you know, it's just a blood pressure cuff kind of thing. Obviously, it would be much smaller, assuming that that is the size difference between your forearm and your... We've taken a wrong turn really quickly.
This is a family program.
I haven't said anything yet. All right, well then let's move on. From the appeal written by Joshua Vaughn, who is a friend of ours. This is just bizarre. So the whole thing here is that I guess the way that I was trying to word this, the article is talking about the people that are getting jammed up for violating, you know, technical violations, things like failing to register or registering late, whatever. That is significantly more number of people that are getting locked up for those things than are committing new offenses. And I guess my thought process behind it is that the sheriff is out there saying, oh my God, we're keeping you safe. Look at all these people, all these sex offenders that have been rearrested. Oh wait, they were violated because they missed curfew, or they didn't actually commit a new offense. So just to throw the idea behind the public that the registry is keeping you safe and all this, that they're going and digging deep to find all these things to report numbers to make it just to justify their existence.
It's part of the industrial complex.
Right.
I'm very disappointed that so little information is in the public hands about when they make these arrests for violating the registry. They make it sound as if the person has never registered. They don't tell them that we were sitting here with a stopwatch and waiting till they went to the 91st day on their 90 day. They don't tell them that we have this really vague statutory scheme that says you have to report all vehicles owned or operated. And if you happen to work in a situation where you happen to drive a company fleet vehicle that's a registry violation.
Right.
It's a part of the registration requirement. There's so many of these little gotcha things to do. If you get a new internet address, if you get a new screen name, you've got in Virginia, you've got like so many hours to report these things. So they've got all these things of a gotcha moment, but they don't constitute any criminality. If anybody in the normal public had all these things they had to do to keep their driver's license current, they would fall through the cracks also. So I'm disappointed that the media, and part of that's our fault because we don't bang their door down and say we want to tell our side of the story. But the media portrays these roundups when they go out and do 40 arrests for registry violations as if these people have done something heinous, and they're being brought in, and they're being brought in for the most minuscule things. And the states just keep stacking more and more requirements on that make it more difficult to not fall into an I got you situation. And not being a conspiracy theorist, it sure does look like one, doesn't it?
It does. And if you happen to be one, Facebook will shut you down.
If you happen to be a conspiracy theorist?
If you start spreading hate speech and conspiracy theories, Facebook will turn off your account. I'm just poking fun at good old Alex Jones. Sorry.
But yes, there are more people are being arrested. I think this was out of Pennsylvania, wasn't it?
It is. It is.
Yeah, more people are being arrested there for violating the registration requirements that are committing sexual offenses. And that's sad because of the people being registered. It's very seldom they're actually registering anybody for failing to register altogether.
It feels to me, Larry, that this would be one of those cases where the statistics would be a useful tool.
Absolutely.
I think 5 years, I might have that number wrong, your recidivism rate has normalized down to what the non-convicted population is. So you are, you know, you're now just background noise with everything else. Shouldn't really, you know, you don't stand out any more than anybody else does.
That is correct. There's no one has a zero risk, I guess, until they're dead or close to being dead. But there's a period of time which the person reverts back to the background risk of the population. But these technical violations, they just stack these, and statistics would be very helpful if we could find a mechanism to accumulate them and assimilate them into a visual that, yes, you did register and you did arrest, you did arrest 142 people last year in this county for violating the registry. One of them had failed to register, and 141 of them were on various technical, and I'd like to line them up. The 141, 70 of them were 5 days late on their 90-day check-in. 24 of them were late because they were homeless and they have to come in every week.
Right.
And they, of course, when you're homeless, you don't have transportation. You can't get to the office. 26 others failed to report a new employment job within 3 days because they have to do it in person in so many states. And if we could start to show this to lawmakers, that's where statistics would be real useful. And we could say, look, out of the 141, they are correct. They did arrest one person.
Yeah.
Who failed to register.
But if it saves one, then that argument kicks back in, which then leads us all the way back down the path of you saying it's unconstitutional to begin with.
That is correct. So I don't care if it saves one or not. You can't punish people to save one. You can punish them during the time that they're being punished, but when their sentence ends, then the punishment ends, and you can't continue to punish people.
Well, I appreciate Joshua for writing this article. It's well done and good information to bring out.
So yeah, we need to have Joshua on the podcast.
I hadn't even thought about that one. I will ask him to, reach out to him and see if he wants to be on. And then this next article, which is not really registry related, but is interesting as far as there being advancements in our treatment of felons. And this comes from governing.com, not a place I've ever heard of. And it is just to briefly cover it, but it appears as though they're taking people while they're still in prison and they're teaching them, I'm going to call them soft skills, but how to navigate like a grocery store, for example. And they take them out and they go, they have supervised visits to the grocery store to try and help them get reintegrated back in society. They specifically reference things like what they do in England in Europe, where how they treat people, where like life in prison is just, it is never a thing in their vocabulary of keeping people locked up for the same way that we do here in the States.
Mm-hmm. This is kind of, we've talked about this, making prison no more punitive than it needs to be, because if people are going to be released, they need to be living as close to a normal life as possible. And the Europeans have figured that out. We're a few decades behind, but this is, I guess there was a trip taken to view the Norwegian model.
We did talk about that. Oh, I don't remember what state it was, but yeah, they had a bunch of like governors or like the Department of Corrections head people go over and looking at their models. We covered that maybe a month or so ago.
Yeah. And, but apparently North Dakota's taking it seriously that they want to try to figure out how to teach people to succeed when they get out. And part of it is how you treat them while they're in.
You would think.
You can't turn them into totally dysfunctional individuals and totally strip them of all their dignity and expect they're magically going to return on the day that they go out the gate.
Hey, so check this out. Towards the bottom of the article, there's a picture of a guard kneeling down. He must be on like solitary because, you know, he's leaned down. His arm is halfway through the chow slot.
I see that. Yeah.
So, but the caption of it, guards are required to have a conversation with every prisoner at least twice a day during their shift.
What an amazing thing.
Some of those, I don't mean to bash all prison guards, but some of those, they're not people you want to be having a conversation with. But bringing that sense of making it a person, yeah, you did something wrong, you need to be punished, but we're not going to turn you into a monster because of it, is a really novel concept.
It really is. For American corrections, we've got a long way to go to adopt that model. And I won't say I'll be dead because that bothered somebody last week, but
yes,
it may be very optimistic to think that we're going to change how we treat offenders in the near future. It just feels too good to be mean to people when we're punishing them. And this is seen as mollycoddling. What they're talking about doing is not what prison is thought to be in America. They're supposed to suffer.
Yeah, it's a really, really bizarre place to be. If you are not mentally strong enough to go into that environment, if you're not mentally prepared, I don't mean to sound like I'm saying you're weak, but you have to be someone pretty spectacular to not be impacted after a significant number of years there, or even a short number of years, I should say.
So, unlike Norwegian counterparts, Birch, who was one of the people, must make do with physical limitations of her prisons, as well as financial constraints. North Dakota is not going to allocate funds for a completely redesigned prison system, at least not anytime soon, which is what I'm saying.
Sure.
And these type of things are long learned term changes, because if we were to decide that we wanted to stop being mean to people, prisons are designed to be very cold.
Yes.
Hard places. They're designed with concrete and steel. They're very loud, very noisy, very very tough to survive in prison. They're not designed for any type of softness. Even the lower security prisons are tough, but of course they're better. I mean, if you're in a lower enough security camp, but our prisons are designed to make you not want to come back.
But we've talked about this before. The prison system isn't a deterrent. I mean, if you need a thing, you're not going to go, God, I really need that gallon of milk, so I'm not going to shoplift because I'll end up in that cold place. Hey, I need those diapers for my kid. I'm going to go do what I got to do.
There are those who think that way, and there are those on the other side who would tell you that there are other options. And Birch is the director of North Dakota Department of Corrections, Leanne Birch. But there'll be people who tell you that there are plenty of options for a person who has no money that they do not have to steal. Now, I don't know what those options are, but there are people listening to this podcast who will tell you that there are options.
Most of them would come. I don't mean to take away from anybody that's been in it. Even just planning hours ahead, maybe there was a food bank open, but that doesn't help you right now. Yes, the person needs the thing and they should have planned ahead, and all these decisions cascade from decades and decades before of bad decisions. That still doesn't help you right now.
That is correct. When you get on the slippery slope and your life begins to unravel, it's hard to build back, regardless of how well intentioned you are making right decisions. When we're in this modern economy, tell me honestly, if you were hiring people, if someone showed up carrying a backpack and they look like they hadn't been able to bathe for some time, which is very, very real for people living on the streets, there are not enough shelters. In this country, not enough shelters for people to have overnight stays where they have nice hygiene. You tell me that they come in, they haven't been in the workforce for a period of time, maybe they got out of prison or whatever, and they come in disheveled. Tell me that you're going to spend time to talk to them and to find out what they might be able to do for you, and that you're going to be open-minded about hiring them. You're going to get on to the next applicant, right? That's
absolutely
what I'm going to do. I'm going to say to you, I'm not in social business here. I'm trying to run a business.
Right. I got to make a profit. So, I mean, that's why I'm in business, is to make a profit.
Oh, well, then you can't talk about profits. But yes, the person who's running the business, even if it's something at entry level type work, like fast food, quick service restaurants, you're not in a position to be able to you can't take that person to go get a razor and shop for shoes and to teach them how to conduct themselves. I mean, you're hoping that they have basic skills and they have some preparedness to go to work.
Which would go back to the previous article with the people in North Dakota.
Yes, and that's what the prisons fall short on. When you give them a paper suit or whatever they give in Georgia and $25, did you get your paper suit, by the way?
I got something, man. I got a brown pair of khakis and a button-down shirt. It was not, I mean, yeah, they were very, very poorly designed.
But when you give someone that and say good luck to you, that is really not going to transition them to productivity.
And just to circle back on what you said about, you know, not enough shelters, most of our people can't go to shelters.
If you have a registry requirement, that's quite often the case. Unfortunately, it's even the case here in my city that shelters are beginning to say no, and I feel very bad about that, because I always thought that we had a decent shelter system here. It's not enough beds, but I thought they were open-minded to letting people come in. But I've come to learn recently that if you're on the list, you're denied shelter. Tragic.
It is. Well, let's move on to, this one is more propeller heady. So this one is: court upholds ex Stanford swimmer's sex assault conviction. And this is from apnews.com. And you wanted to highlight where the 3-judge panel of the 6th District Court of Appeal in San Jose ruled Wednesday that there was substantial evidence that Brock Turner received a fair trial. I think that's what the key for this one, that the reason why you wanted to cover it.
Even more narrowly focused, the primary issue on Brock's appeal, for those who don't remember, he is the Stanford swimmer that got the 6 months. It's a recommendation of the probation department, and then a probated sentence for the remainder. And then he got national attention. The judge got recalled by the voters, and the law was since changed. They have to impose a mandatory minimum of much longer. I think it's either 2 or 3 years.
For I think it's 3. Yep.
But Brock appealed his conviction. He went to trial, and he appealed his conviction. And he argued that the evidence was not sufficient. And I was wanting to make the point that if you don't have anything more for your appeal than just saying the evidence is not sufficient, you're not likely to go very far with that appeal, because the sufficiency of the evidence standard is a very low one for the state to meet, because the appellate court takes the position that we weren't there. We didn't sit through the trial. We didn't watch the twitching witnesses. We didn't watch we're not in a position to evaluate the credibility. Therefore, the posture we're going to take as an appellate court is we're going to look as was there enough evidence that a jury could find that person guilty, or the opposite of that, is this verdict so outrageous that there's just absolutely no way that a reasonable jury could conclude that there was evidence to convict them. And if they don't find that that situation, they're going to uphold your sufficiency of the evidence is not going to get you anywhere. And of course, when you told Brock that when he's doing the appeal, he would not want to hear it, because he would, of course, want to get his conviction overturned. But when you're doing appellate work, you need to tell the person, if all we've got is you're going to say that the evidence wasn't sufficient, you're destined to get to a dead end, because the appellate court is going to give the utmost deference to the trier of fact, be it a judge or a jury, and they're not going to second guess how they evaluated and weighted those witnesses and that evidence.
This feels like someone that's on death row. They got, and we'll just say that they're wrongly convicted, but they got convicted and they can't get a new trial because there's no new evidence to redo anything. Is that the same thing? Is it similar?
Similar, yes. This is not exactly the same thing, but this person is saying that jury got it wrong because the evidence just wasn't there. And the appellate court saying, yes, we see that the jury had enough evidence, and that was a question before them in Brock's case. They had ample evidence to convict him, and they will only flip that verdict if they look at that and say there's no way that you could come to that outcome. That's a tough road to hoe when you're saying there was not enough evidence. It was kind of like it's been quite a number of years ago when George W. Bush was president, that we had shots fired into Mexico, and I think that the Border Patrol agents were convicted and sentenced to prison, and the Bush ended up commuting their sentences. But they lost. They said there wasn't sufficient evidence. Well, there was plenty of evidence. You fired into Mexico.
That could almost be construed as an act of war.
Yeah. But the evidence was there. There was evidence this person was sexually assaulted. And I think that if I remember right, he was pulled off of her.
That is he got discovered and allegedly ran away. He says he didn't run away. He doesn't remember it happening that way.
So there was ample evidence, so the appellate court wasn't going to disturb that finding of the jury. He's got to find new issues
right
to undo his conviction, but that one's primarily going to be a dead end. So I wanted to let the listeners know, if that's all you got, you need to dig in your arsenal and look for more, because that's usually not going to work.
Well, let's move on to the super duper fun article of the week, in which I have the news clipping, and this is, I think this is CBS in like the morning program, whatever that one's called. Have a listen.
Well, police in Cincinnati are investigated what prompted an off-duty officer to fire his stun gun at an 11-year-old girl. Authorities say the officer suspected the girl was shoplifting Monday at a Kroger supermarket where he worked another job. The officer approached her, but they say she tried to flee. That's when he used his stun gun to shock her in the back. The girl's mother is demanding answers.
I don't want nothing else to happen. I don't want it to happen to nobody else's kids. because it could have been worse. It could have been a gun.
The 11-year-old was charged with theft and obstruction of justice, but those charges have now been dropped.
The officer is on restricted duty pending an investigation. The police union has not responded to our request for comment. In a statement, Cincinnati police told CBS News, quote, "We are extremely concerned when force is used by one of our officers on a child of this age. As a result, we will be taking a very thorough review of our policies." Current Cincinnati police policy allows tasers to be used on people who are as young as 7. Kroger tells CBS News it's assisting local law enforcement with their investigation.
That's one of those ones you're scratching your head. You can tase little kids at the age of 7. No, there's always two sides to every story, but it seems like a better way to handle that one.
Mm-hmm. Right.
All right. They can hit people at the age of 7 with their stun guns? 7?
I was shocked when I think I'm the one that dropped this in here because of how shocked I was when I saw that. And I put it in because I want to remind people that the police work for us. And the reason why they have these policies is because we're not demanding that they don't have them. It's like chaining a pregnant woman who's in jail to a bed to give birth.
Yes.
I don't know of any history of a woman fleeing and being able to run when they're in the middle of childbirth. I don't have any personal experience, but I suspect it's very difficult. Tasing an 11-year-old girl. She may have been shoplifting. Kroger, do the right thing. Sever your relationship with the Cincinnati Police Department because they were not capable of handling this intelligently. And since they have not said unequivocally that this won't happen again, they should be able to immediately change the policy. They should not need to convene all these meetings and studies. We don't taser children in the United States of America, not 7 years old. So if they can't renounce that policy, the officer or any officer of the Cincinnati Police should never be allowed in another Kroger store to work.
All right, let me reword what you're saying. So they have stated that they have a policy that they can hit people at the age of 7. This girl was 11, and what you're then saying is like they are complicit in this, and since they have not rolled it back fast enough and hard enough and like hardline, this is what it is, that they are trying to possibly like wait it out and let the dust settle and they'll keep the policy in place?
It would be possible depending on the community pushback. Now, the parent was quite angry, of course.
Yeah.
But we need to hear a lot of parents being quite angry. Whether it's your child or not, you should be outraged that a child would be tasered in the back by a police officer with heavy weaponry because they might have shoplifted something. Now, I'm not condoning shoplifting, so you don't need to send in all your emails and phone calls saying that I'm condoning shoplifting. I wish the 11-year-old wasn't shoplifting if that, in fact, was the case. But we don't taser children for shoplifting. End of discussion. Kroger, do the right thing. Don't let them in your stores again for off-duty protection. And Cincinnati citizens, tell your elected officials that you want this policy changed. Demand that it be changed.
I can't,
don't just sit back and hope that it works itself out.
I can't imagine what the I know that they have to make 10 dozen scenario decisions while they're going through this, and nothing popped up on his head and said, all right, she shoplifted a Kit Kat bar. It's 50 cents. My response will be, tase the bitch. I mean, seriously?
Well, there are people who will say that she should have complied, and they're listening to this podcast. I don't know how many, but there'll be people who would say
I've heard it from people say it to me.
Yeah, and they generally speaking, I would agree that it's probably not good to advise kids to run from the police. But the child was in a minority community where the police don't have the best of reputation for being helpful. And her experience in life with her relatives and siblings may have taught her that the police were not necessarily your friend. So she did what instinct did. She ran. But you don't taser the child. There's not a life-threatening situation.
Yes.
If a cop doesn't have enough judgment to know not to do that, he or she should not be on the police department. You're not cut out for this type of work. Go ahead and turn in your badge and move on to something else.
And we could also then say, there are security cameras everywhere, even if it's not the Kroger cameras, which I guarantee you they have a security system in their store. There are then other cameras around. You can probably, within a reasonable amount of legwork and detective work, figure out who the kid is and bring the evidence. And you could, I don't think you can charge the kid, really. I mean, maybe, but I mean, that, you know, you're not going to go send him to life in prison for this, but you could probably backtrack and figure out where the kid came from.
Possibly. And I'm just so outraged because, and the reason I put this additional was because this is what I'm talking about us. When we stop tolerating police abuse, it will stop happening. When it begins to outrage the average citizen, as I'm outraged, and we express that outrage, it will no longer be tolerated. It's tolerated because we're silent.
I understand your point very well. Can we circle back just real quick when people have said they should have complied? So in part of the story, they're saying that the officer said stop and she didn't. So she kept going, whatever, and he tases her. And then there was the video maybe a month ago of like the 100-pound kid at the Waffle House being like almost lifted up like Darth Vader in front of the Waffle House for having an altercation. And the response I get is, well, he shouldn't have had the altercation. Absolutely, he shouldn't have had it. But then when you get this 300-pound Goliath coming at you and you're just supposed to comply with it's yes, they should, but that's not always the answer. I just wanted to circle back and get your thoughts on that whole scenario or these scenarios in general, because this is not an isolated incident.
Well, the person that says, or the people that say that, believe that you justify a law enforcement misbehavior by refusal to comply, I don't buy into that. They're basically giving the cop the license to escalate and do whatever they want to do if you don't comply. I doubt there's any one of us who haven't been skipping school or done something that we didn't want to be seen and we didn't take off running, whether it be setting off bottle rockets or whatever things that kids do, and tell me that you didn't run from the police at some point in your life and try to get away from an adult that was going to catch you doing something. Of course you did.
But you end up in front of legislators, and I'm going to assume that they have presented you with that kind of argument. Do you have a response to it?
Something similar to what I just did. I remind them that you were a kid and you did crazy things. This was an 11-year-old child that was shoplifting.
I know.
There was no threat of injury to anyone except for the injury that the cop inflicted by tasing the child.
I can't even imagine.
There was an economic injury possibly in place, which, I mean, economic injuries are important, but that's not an appropriate proportional response for a shoplifter, particular child, to be tased.
All right. So it's not a Walmart. So she wasn't walking out with a big screen TV. I'm not saying that there's not high dollar stuff at a Kroger. Some of them have some, you know, halfway decent stuff, but it could have been that much money she was walking out with.
Well, and I'm not justifying the shoplifting, but
no, I know.
I'm condemning the reaction.
Yeah.
We don't tase people, particularly children. Don't you feel embarrassed? Don't you feel embarrassed being an American when you have somebody here from a foreign country, and they would never even dream of their law enforcement doing that? Doesn't it kind of make you wonder what happened and how your country went off of the rails when you have that happening here? People from England are shocked when they come here, and the cops are so heavily armed. And if you look at British photographs, you remember the one recently where they took the guy into custody? I think we had a clip of it, it was either in Canada or in England.
Canada.
Yeah,
and they talked him down.
Yeah, but around the world they're shocked at us, but somehow we think that we have it right.
Yeah.
And the rest of the world has it wrong. And they incarcerate a fraction of the people we do. They reintegrate their offenders into productive lives after they've been incarcerated. And they have more fair economic systems. When I hear people talk about what countries they'd like to live in, I always hear these countries that we like to think that they never say Somalia. They never say Bangladesh. They always say these European countries, particularly the ones that have nice social service, where they have education all the way through college and they have universal health care. It's amazing that that's the countries that people like. Well, they don't shoot their kids in the back with a taser when they're 11 years old in those countries.
You're just crazy, Larry. I don't know where you get these crazy ideas. It seems like it'd be okay to shoot kids in the back with a taser. I think that's all right. I don't know why you have a problem with it. Crazy. All right. So from the Tennessean, there is an article talking about diabetic inmates. At Tennessee's largest prison, diabetic inmates say they are denied insulin to maximize profits. Insulin stuff is not cheap. It is definitely not cheap. But you'll flat out die if you don't get it within a very short period of time. Couple of days, I think, and you're going to be in a real world of hurt.
This one I put in, I'm also over my head like I am on the heat.
Yeah.
But I have a diabetic family member, and I know that it's very expensive. Fortunately for her, she gets it on the dole because she's on Medicaid. But I put it in primarily because privatization in prisons. I always harp about how I've never heard anybody say they like private prisons better, and I have one or two exceptions where people say I did like it better because it was air conditioned. Mm. But I've never heard a mad rush of people wanting to go over to privatized prisons. But if people's health is being compromised, there again, that should outrage you. The person, they were sentenced to a loss of their freedom, not to lay there and have, what is it, a seizure you have?
Yeah, you would have diabetic shock, and you would go into a coma eventually, and you would ultimately die.
Yeah. I mean, that's not what they were sentenced to. And I know they should have thought about that before they got there. But the problem is they're there.
Yes.
And they're now our responsibility to keep them safe and to keep them reasonably healthy. And if that's true in Tennessee, if you're doing that to maximize profits, shame on you.
Well, this is CoreCivic. I this wouldn't necessarily be Tennessee is doing this. This is CoreCivic. This is one of the two biggies.
But they're the ones who gave the contract to allow the privatization, which we have plenty of private prisons here in my state. But the state has to demand that the standards for healthcare be met, or there are consequences.
I mean, at least in my experience, there's some sort of state level representative, a liaison there on the camp, and he would then, or she, they would have oversight as to how people are being treated and if they're meeting the standards set at the state. So, I mean, I get what you're saying, that it is Tennessee's fault for giving them. They're just a proxy of it. Let me ask you this question. Where was I just going to go? Can you define what ward of the state would mean?
Well, I would define it. I don't know if it's a legal definition, but I would define it as anybody who's being cared for by the state, whether it be a foster child or anyone who's at the mercy of the state. A child, I was a ward of the state when I was growing up, and I would say that anybody who's in a state prison is a ward of the state because you're not able to fend for yourself.
And this would then extend to people in prison where, I mean, yeah, you can wipe your butt, but otherwise you're not feeding yourself, you are not recreating yourself, you are not educating yourself. These are all services that are provided to you because you need them. I mean, they provide you with toilet paper. You don't have any, you don't need, and I'm being very specific with the word need. You don't need any possessions. They're going to give you your clothes, food, everything. You can just kind of lay down for your time. They have to provide everything for you.
Well, and you're not in a position to provide it for yourself.
Right.
By and large, I mean, there are commissaries in most correctional facilities that are serve as a profit center, and sometimes the profits go for the good of the inmates, and sometimes it goes for the good of the institution. But you are not able to provide your health care. You're not able to provide your medication. You're not able to provide much for yourself. And if you think it's too expensive, here's my suggestion to you, Tennessee. If it costs too much to incarcerate people, stop doing it.
Yeah, incarcerate less.
Yes, stop doing it. It's in your control. The prosecutors complain about their heavy caseloads. Well, you're the only part of the system that has control over that. Stop filing cases. Your caseload will get a whole lot lighter.
Larry, did you see John Oliver? Do you ever watch John Oliver?
Occasionally, but not anymore since I don't have satellite.
Okay, well, this one we almost need to stop the podcast so you can watch this. But he covered prosecutors this week, and it was a 20-minute run of prosecutors, and you know, we covered it very early in the podcast about the entire system that we are dealing with, the overrunning prisons that is almost entirely under the control of prosecutors. And he went through all that, and then the corruption of it, and not saying all prosecutors are bad, but there are bad ones, but it was amazing. And he's got a huge audience, probably 10 million people, I'm going to guess, watch that. Now, you know, I'm assuming that if they're watching it, they agree with it. It's not that he's changing minds. These are people in our camp already. But great for him to cover. He covers criminal justice stuff fairly regularly.
Absolutely. Well, I shouted out on one of our podcasts of what I thought was an ethical prosecutor. Of course, he lost his job.
The guy in Philly lost his job?
Well, I don't know him. I knew when the prosecutor in Boulder lost his job over the JonBenet Ramsey case. But because he tried to file charges only when he had evidence. His office had ethics, him and Peter Hoftram, who was his chief deputy. They actually believed that the state had too much power, and they used it sparingly when they had actually a case they could prove. And they refused to lock up the Ramseys because they said the evidence just doesn't support that. And he was dropped out of office over that. So I shouted out for Alex Hunter and Peter Hoftram. If you're listening, of course, that'd be unlikely, but they were both great guys.
Okay. I'm sorry. I jumped the gun. I thought you were talking about the Philadelphia guy because you talked about ethical prosecutors.
Well, Alex and Peter were both ethical prosecutors, and I don't know what they're doing these days, but shout out for both of them.
And Marie on Twitter asked, and this even circles back around to the Twitter post I just played for us, but and she asks, if a kid has a right, I've heard of these cases where a kid doesn't like his parents, they're always fighting, whatever, and they can take their parents to court to divorce themselves. I guess they gain, I don't know what the legal term would be, but they gain their independence, you know, maybe before they're 18. Why don't, like the kid from the Ohio dad, why don't those kind of kids then take the state to court saying that you've taken away my father?
I like it, Maria. I really like that. I think that's going to be an avenue that has yet to be developed and hasn't been thought a lot about. But the collateral consequences on the family member, whether it be the child or the spouse or whoever, the collateral consequences. I even talked about property managers who are not allowed to rent to people because they're not allowed to have people congregate more than one in their building. They have an economic interest to do business in America. But I think that a kid... you run into barriers because depending on the age of the child, they really can't navigate the system. They're going to have an attorney act on their behalf on how is the attorney going to be funded. But if they can overcome those barriers, a child bring in an action saying that I would love to have my dad or my mom or both my parents at school together, watching me play sports at my parent-teacher meetings, whatever they call those things these days, where you have a conference about your kid's educational plans. Oh,
parent-teacher conference.
Yeah, that would be fantastic for a child to say that I'm suffering. And I'd like to, because there would be experts out there that would be willing to come in if they were paid, that they would say that it's critical that both parents be present in a child's upbringing. So I love it, Maria. And I hope that we can figure out some way to begin to test this theory that a parent, a child can bring the action and say that what the state is doing to them is not constitutional because they're depriving them of their parent, which is necessary. For their proper upbringing.
So I can just see this. A friend of mine just ended up in a defect situation where the defects came in threatening to take away the kids. Do you think we could invert that? And you go to school and you have you go see your school counselor and you go, man, I'm having a hard time at home. My dad's on the registry and he can't be with us. And I just really want my dad. That prompts a call to defects. DFACS then becomes our advocate because I'm just going to assume that they would think that having a family together would be better. And then they end up taking the state to court to get the family back together.
Well, I like your thinking, but
is it a parallel universe that will never happen?
I like your thinking. Now, let's clear. Remember, you're talking to a global audience. For those of you who are not in Georgia, DFACS for that is the Georgia Department of Family and Children Services. That's the acronym DFACS. DFACS is not likely to bring such an action, but it would be novel if you went to DFACS and said that I have this issue and I want you to help me because you're supposed to be promoting healthy family child relationships. I'd be interested to know what DFACS would say if such a person went there and made that claim.
It seems that their sole interest is in the kids having a healthy upbringing. It feels then that every child psychologist would say that having parents together is better, not always the ideal situation, but it would be better than being individual. That seems kind of like a no-brainer, but I can't see it gaining any traction because all I know of DFACS is them going in and swiping kids away from families because dad said a cuss word when he got home from work.
No, I think that might be a tad of a stretch of swiping a kid away for that. I'd hate to put that one on DFACS. Remember, I was swiped away by DFACS myself. I know
that it's not a perfect situation, and I think their intentions are right. But I think, like me too, this is just my personal opinion. Like the Me Too movement, it has been going on for so long that the pendulum has swung the other way. There have been kids that have been beaten and abused for so long. The pendulum has swung the other way, where at the slightest thing of inappropriate behavior, like you're at the grocery store and your kid starts acting up and you swat them on the hiney, now all the parents are running around with their cell phone cameras saying, I'm going to call DFACS on you.
That does happen. The overwhelming reports to Child Protective Services, which would be DFACS in Georgia, but those cases are closed without any rigorous intervention. They only act in a small number of cases where they actually intervene. So it's not like they're going out grabbing up kids galore. We don't have the money and the resources in the foster families to place children. So removing a child from a home is an extreme remedy, and it's very sparingly used to this very day. It's hard to take a child, and if you do take them, it's very temporary, and they end up being returned to the family. And of course, I have a little problem with that because sometimes the biological family is not the best place for them to be.
Absolutely.
But our emphasis is on family reunification. We believe that somehow if you produce the child, that's where you belong, and we end up putting people back in situations. Here in my state, we've had some high-profile cases where the kids have ultimately suffered and died because they were put back in unfit families.
Well, there was an article this week, the family, and not to go on a religious bent, the family said that we're going to pray for our kid, and they let the kid starve to death at 10 days old.
I don't see a problem with that.
No, and there's some, not funny, the pictures of the parents being read the charges, the mom breaks down and cries, and then when they say you could be facing life in prison, the dad's like, what? Yeah, they let the kids starve. It was like super duper malnourished and dehydrated, and the kid was 10 days old and died from the elements, whatever, of dehydration and malnourishment.
Now, everybody, please don't take me serious when I said I don't see a problem with it. I absolutely see a problem with that.
Absolutely.
I was being sarcastic about people who think religious, that they ought to be able to do anything in the name of religion. And that was not intended to be the least bit serious. So I don't want a flood of call. I can't believe that he said that he didn't.
I only bring that up as the inverse of what we were just talking about, of here is where DFACS should have gone in. Child Protective Services should have gone in, but they probably didn't know because 10 days, your kid's not running around crying to the neighbors. You know, the kid's locked in a room or whatever, but they just sat there and watched the kid die. It's unfathomable to me. And then you would bring in Protective Services to protect the kid, and that would be the obvious answer there. So it goes both ways.
Absolutely. Well, it's tragic that happened, and I do not believe for one moment that they should let a child die. So
nope.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
And now we are going to move on to the feature subject of the night, which is about civil commitment. And I guess this relates around the, I can't remember the guy's name, but tell me the guy's name again.
Galen Boffman.
And people may know who he is. He's the one that went around and did a TED talk saying everybody's a sex offender, growing up as a youth and discovering he's a homosexual, and eventually gets, I don't even know what, I guess he was convicted of a minor relationship. So he was an adult and he had a minor victim. serves his time, comes out and ends up on the circuit doing these kind of speeches. And I mean, I saw it. I thought it was great. But that speech was, so many people in society could have been convicted of something that would have put them on the registry. So his then mantra was that everybody's a sex offender. But since he's been out of prison, he decided to maybe make some poor life decisions, and texting people didn't necessarily do quote unquote illegal activity, but bad decisions and probation violations, right?
Correct. He had violated let's go back to his youth. He apparently had a youthful offense when he was a teenager with a minor that was even younger. And then as a young adult, he was engaged in a relationship with a minor. And the minor was, I think, one or a few days under 14. And then they made it when he reached 14. There was some playing around with the ages, but he had a consensual relationship with someone that was not old enough to give consent. So he ended up doing a prison term, and then they sought his civil commitment in Virginia, and they petitioned for commitment as a sexually violent predator. And as far as I can determine, all the information that's been provided, there was actually no violence in that relationship of a consensual nature. But they petitioned for his commitment, and they lost, which put him out of prison under supervision. Well, he was able to travel freely, amazingly, around the country and around the world. He came to the Los Angeles conference, and I think he came to maybe the Dallas conference. And he was able to travel somewhat internationally, amazingly, and he was on supervision in 2016, and his texts were to a teenage boy in Minneapolis area, Minneapolis, St. Paul. And I read the text, and I don't think we need to get into the detail in the podcast, but they were of a nature that a parent would not approve, to say the least. And there was suggestion that the young man slip away and meet up with him, and very distasteful, certainly under supervision. The age of consent, I think, is 16 in Minnesota. So there would not have been a criminality for having sex, but his supervision conditions expressly forbade him to be having contact with minors. So he violated his probation, which has resulted in him being given a year of extra incarceration plus some very rigid probation conditions. And the Attorney General of Virginia has filed a second petition to commit him. And I thought it'd be a great opportunity to talk about civil commitment, because NARSL stands opposed to civil commitment as it's applied to sexual offenders. So I thought, well, what great timing. We can talk about civil commitment.
Well, tell me, I think I've heard people say that there are 20 states that allow civil commitment. And I did some research today, and there's truth in it, but also not so much truth in it.
Well, there's truth in it in terms of the sex offender specific civil commitment, which is a separate track. But as far as I know, all states have a regular civil commitment process. And I'm not aware of a state that doesn't have civil commitment. The federal government has civil commitment. In fact, we had a high profile case of a presidential attempted assassination in 1981 of Ronald Reagan. And the person was civilly committed because he was found not guilty by reason of insanity. So he was very much civilly committed.
But then he was recently released, so he spent 35 or 40 years civilly committed, correct?
Yes, he spent probably the closure of St. Elizabeth Hospital that helped expedite his departure, because they've turned that, or in the process of converting that to some national security, homeland security facility. But he spent decades in St. Elizabeth's Hospital, and there was no way he was going to be released while Ronald Reagan was alive, and Ronald Reagan passed him in 2004. And he didn't only shoot Reagan, he shot press secretary James Brady. Brady. Yeah. And then three officers from, I used to name all three of them, Delahanty. And there was officers of the DC Metro Police. And there were multiple shootings.
James Brady was the worst for wear, though.
Yeah. James got the worst of it. He had the worst of injuries of everybody, and he's now deceased. And I don't know of the officers, if any of them live. Of course, Reagan died in 2004, but that was civil commitment. So when the people say 20 states have civil commitment, they're kind of misinformed, because as far as I know, all states have civil commitment. but there's a separate track for sex offenders, and the standards are different and the processes are different. And that's what we wanted to talk about tonight.
All right. So I'm assuming, I like to take things to ridiculous extremes. So you could be convicted of the most benign kind of sexual offense, and they go, oh, you're a threat to society, so we're going to civilly commit you. I know that's an extreme example, but that's what this essentially allows for them to do. Instead of it being, hey, you're up on top of the water tower trying to threaten to jump that you're committing suicide, we're going to go put you on ice for a couple days to, that would be civilly committing. We're not, you're not being guilty of a crime necessarily. You are a danger to yourself or others. So they put you under supervision for a handful of days.
That is a good analogy. The sex offender civil commitments, and they vary from the states that have the specific track. The tracks for regular civil commitment are very similar in terms of you have to be an imminent danger to yourself or others. And it's a pretty high bar to meet. So the commitment periods are generally very brief, for like an observation period of 72 hours. And then they have to come back and tell the court with precision what it is that you're a threat to do. And the court will extend the commitment for another period of time. But it's fairly robust, and it's very sparingly used because it's expensive to put people up. And then you have people who are in the criminal justice system who are being evaluated for mental illness because they might be considering that as a defense of a mental defect. And so the hospital, they're holding custody of those people in a civil setting because they haven't been convicted. But those commitments are different than what we're talking about here. They word these statutes in such a way that they don't have the high standard to overcome. They'll say that the person has a mental abnormality, and they don't really define an abnormality very well. And they say they have a mental abnormality that makes it likely that they'll do something dangerous, and they don't define dangerous very well, that they present a danger to the community. I want those laws to be defined where they say that they have a mental illness that makes it likely that they will commit an act of violence. And an act of violence is defined clearly to use the Webster definition of violence, because we've over-defined violence. But they have these very broad definitions. Like in Virginia, they have, I think, something like 20 offenses that are called predicate offenses that will allow for them to consider a person for civil commitment after they've done their prison time. So they go through this process after they've done their prison time, and magically, they don't need any mental health when they're locking them up.
Right.
They lock them up, they have them do hard time, they treat them as hard criminals. And then when they get to the end of their sentence, toward the end, then the state magically decides that they have a mental abnormality, and they file a petition. And within that universe of people that they can file a petition on, which is quite large, there was a study that I referred to in a report that we're about to issue at NARSL about Virginia specifically, and the criticism we have of this case. The universe of people, they sought commitment of 17% of the people that had a predicate offense during the study period. But the amount of people that were eligible went up exponentially because they started doing the static 99 as being the primary evaluating tool. And so there's a large universe of people that are eligible to be considered. The attorney general filed the petition on 17. They were presented with the eligibility for 17% of the people that were being released from prison, and they filed on 60% of those that were eligible. Well, they won on 89% of the filings. So Galen Boffman was in the small group of people who the AG did not win where they chose to file. So they're taking a second bite on Galen, which is very troubling for us because he hasn't committed another predicate sexual offense.
Can you give me the definition of predicate? That predicate is a victim-oriented crime. Is that correct?
It would be a list of on the Virginia list, which would take too long to go over. But there's a list of offenses that make a person eligible, and he has not committed a new sexual offense. Period.
Right. Okay.
So he doesn't have a sexual offense, or much less a predicate sexual offense. So therefore, what they're getting is a second bite at the apple on the original predicate sexual offense that they lost. And that's very troubling. Whether or not we like Galen or not, NARSL is about due process. And due process is when an issue has been adjudicated previously and there's been a decision made, there's res judicata, which is a Latin term. They're going back to try to commit him again. Well, the statute doesn't say that they cannot, but it doesn't say they can.
But doesn't that Does this not fall into your constitutional rights? And that's Fifth Amendment for double jeopardy, right?
Well, not really, because it's a civil proceeding.
All right. Okay.
But that's where the res judicata comes in. They've already had a decision made on this predicate offense. They've already had a trial in 2012. And in 2012, the jury did not believe that Boffman met the definition. So now the attorney general said, well, he's done some crude text and he might be grooming. Well, he might be, and he might not be, since the age of consent is 16. So he might have been doing nothing but violating probation, which is, I'm not minimizing that.
Certainly.
Probation conditions are there for a reason. I think they're overly harsh in some cases, but he was clearly adjudicated to have violated his probation. I don't have to make that determination. The court already has. But to try to commit him again raises serious questions because he has not committed a criminal offense. So it brings out a whole host of deficiencies in the Virginia system of civil commitment, because in order to write about it, I had to study it. And I found out that there was a report issued in 2012, 6.5 years ago,
right,
requested by the legislature, sent to the governor and to the legislature, that identified serious defects in how they're committing people. And as far as I can tell, very little, if any, of those recommendations have been adopted.
Hmm. Okay.
The process there is, in most states, is seriously flawed. They're locking people away. They have, in Virginia, to their credit, they do give them an attorney up to $5,000, which some states don't do that, to my understanding, but they do give them an attorney. That's really not enough for something that could put you away for life.
Right.
It's better than not getting any attorney at all. But what they discovered in the report was that the attorneys from the 104 jurisdictions they have around the state, the attorneys that get assigned, because it's the jurisdiction where the predicate offense happens, is where they file to commit. There may be an attorney that has very little experience, because that may be a small jurisdiction and they've done no previous petitions, or they've done one. And the attorney has no experience in trying to prepare for this life-altering, potentially lifetime commitment. And he or she's going to get their $5,000, but they're woefully underprepared. And the report pointed that out. They also pointed out that the judges are woefully underprepared. They pointed out, like in the cities of Richmond, where they are handling a lot more cases, the judges are familiar with what the standards are, how to proceed, and they're willing to say, no, this person doesn't qualify. So the luck of the draw, if you were in a smaller community where the attorneys and judges are not as familiar, you had 100% chance of being committed. That's wrong. I mean, we don't like the whole process to start with, because we think it's nothing but voodoo. If they had a mental illness, they should have been treated as a mentally ill person, and they shouldn't. But if you're going to commit a person, the process should be fair and robust to the person, and the standards should be very tough for the state to meet, like a regular civil commitment. It shouldn't be because you don't like the person. They might do something. They should be a very dangerous individual when we have to take their freedom away and put them in something similar to a cage. And even civil commitment, although some facilities are more like hospitals, but some facilities are nothing more than prisons.
Right.
Just like prisons.
Do you think this is any sort of witch hunt for homosexuality?
I wasn't able to find any evidence that confirmed that. What I did find evidence of is that the Static 99, which people know that's an evaluation tool that's used, it does have a bias for men who have male victims. There's extra points for that, which that's how it brings you into the zone of being petitioned, because they use that as their primary evaluating tool in Virginia. Well, do you have to be a homosexual to have a male victim? What was Dennis Hastert, the former House Speaker, a homosexual? Was Jerry Sandusky a homosexual? He had male victims. I don't know if it's a conspiracy to homosexuals. I'm not ready to pronounce that without evidence, but it certainly has a bias with those with male victims to use that tool.
And if I'm not mistaken, the Static 99, that is not the DSM. That is not something there are things that the Static 99 covers that are not considered mental illnesses.
Well, it's basically about your victim profile, how many offenses you've had, what age, what your victim profile was, and then age, where they give you points. If you've had a relationship, if you were married in a stable relationship, you get 0 points. If you have never had a relationship, you get a point. If you're under 25 when you first, well, he was, so he got a point for that. And then he had male victim, he got points for that.
Interesting.
That's a flawed a tool. But and the JLARC report pointed out that the eligibility criteria went up 450% when they right. switched to that being the primary mechanism. So you have basically a fivefold increase of people who are eligible to be committed.
And just for the ladies that are listening, demand your equal rights. And if you're a female victim, you get a point.
I doubt there's very many people going to make that assertion.
That's just, I mean, I'm trying to think of the rationale behind, I mean, so if a woman were committing these crimes and she has a male victim, she gets a point, reverse the roles. And now you don't get a point.
If it's male on female, there's no point. If it's female on male, there's no point. But if it's male on male, there's a point.
What if it's woman on woman or woman on girl?
That's not in the static 99. You can
come on,
can,
man. That's can, totally biased towards that. Then there's no way around that.
Well, then we need to have the transgender. No, that wouldn't be transgender.
Not trans. It's just homo. Like LGBT.
Yeah. We need to contact them and find out if they're going to push for that equality.
And you already said it. So this is a civil proceeding, not criminal. And please, just briefly, what is the difference?
Well, the difference is in the burden of proof. To convict a person of a crime, it has to be proof beyond a reasonable doubt. In the civil setting, the standard is lower, and the expectations. You have certain rights that you don't have in a civil proceeding. You can remain silent all throughout a criminal trial. In a civil proceeding, I suppose in this commitment, you can remain silent. It's not to your advantage to do that because they need information if you have any that will help you avoid commitment. But the standard of proof oftentimes is so lax that they could, if they bring the petition, well, 89% is a 90% success rate, you might as well say. If they tried 9 times out of 10, they were going to win.
Yeah.
In that study period, your odds were not very, very good of beating civil commitment.
And you did say that they, like Virginia, they'll give you like a $5,000 allowance for an attorney. Do you have a right to an attorney? If you're being charged criminally, your Miranda rights kick in and you have a right to an attorney and so forth, correct?
Correct. You don't have such a right in a civil proceeding. And that's where the state legislatures fall short when they're designing these things. And they also provide in Virginia for expert witnesses. I believe they're entitled to an equal amount. So the person whose commitment is sought has a right to experts of their own choosing to go against the state hospital. The evaluation, they have a particular facility where they send these people to be evaluated. And that's one of the complaints they have with Galen. His attorneys have is that apparently the systems evaluator that went said that he didn't qualify. So they used their own internal funds and they went out and hired a separate evaluator. Well, I think that's a little bit tacky. I don't think Alex Hunter would have done that if in Colorado, but I don't see any prohibition against it in the statute. So ethics are different than something that's prohibited. And they argued that's prohibited. Well, I was not able to using their citations that they put in their narrative. I could not confirm that to the contrary, there was no prohibition. But apparently that's what they did. They went out and hired them an independent evaluation. And amazingly, guess what? She decided that he is eligible to be committed and recommended his commitment. And we're very troubled about this entire case. But we're troubled more from the system point of view, because the system has been identified for 6.5 years as being terribly flawed. And the Virginia government, the legislature, and the governor have not done much about it. And people having their freedom taken away, and they do get an opportunity to be reviewed periodically, but you shouldn't be locked up in the United States unless you're extremely dangerous. And it appears like in Virginia, you can be locked up for a lot less than being extremely dangerous.
Well, in this particular case, you can send some, you know, inappropriate text messages and get yourself locked up for life. And that's what I was just going to say. So you can end up in a situation where you are under the threat of being locked up for the rest of your life and not end up with representation.
That's my understanding, that some of the statutes are so defective that they do not mandate that they be provided representation. Now, I can't cite to which one. So if anybody, there's got to be experts out there in the audience that know more about sex offender civil commitment than I do. I studied this particular one because our board wanted to know what position to take on it. But I understand from those who say how horrible it is that they end up being railroaded without representation.
Now here's where I want to go with this. Very, very, very early in our history, I brought up the case of the guy in Norway, somewhere up there, and he mowed down like 70 people and he got like 20 years in prison. And we just talked about that in those countries in Europe, they just don't believe in life in prison. So these are the worst people that you could imagine, and they can't get life in prison. In the United States, a guy sends a nasty text message to a minor and he could get life in prison without representation.
Well, in Virginia, he's entitled to representation.
Throw the situation into another state where maybe they don't, maybe they have $1,000 and you're an attorney and like, I'm not taking $1,000 to try and represent this guy. I've got, you know, 100 hours of work that I've got to put in here to defend this guy. I'm not doing that for $1,000.
It would be tragic. And I would like to know if any listeners out there are aware of the most effective civil commitment state. I know in Minnesota they've litigated that all the way up to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the process was deemed constitutional there. But this process of Virginia, although I don't like it, it looks like they did try to design it with some fairness in place to give the person a chance
and then
to have representation.
And once you get in there, how do you get out?
There's a review process where the person, the attorney general, can fight the review process. There's a process by which they can be reviewed and a committee can recommend, and then the attorney general can object. And I believe they get the same level of funding again. And so it's a very expensive program. The report identified they spend about $90,000 a year per person. And I don't know if that includes the attorney general. At the time that was written, they had six dedicated attorneys, and they said that their need would increase because as more and more people are whose commitment they have to seek, and then as more and more people are eligible for the review hearings, that they're going to be doing more and more hearings. But the $90,000, that's a lot of money to incarcerate people.
Without any, I mean, how would you look at that from like a funding standpoint? It's like, if you convict somebody and you say they're going to spend 5 years in prison, and that Philadelphia article we covered months ago, that was what the attorney general wanted them to do. The prosecutor say, hey, look, if you're going to lock up somebody for 3 years, write down $40,000 a year times three. So that's going to be, we're going to charge the state $120,000 to put that person behind bars. Flip that over to this. You're going to be locked up indefinitely at $90,000. How do you budget that at the state level?
Well, that's one of the things the report identified. It's an escalating cost problem that they have because the population is ever increasing, and it crowds out other funding because Virginia, like most states, tends to want to be taxes are evil, and you have all these competing things to fund. And at some point, they're going to have a rational discussion about how many people we can afford to commit. And maybe we should change the criteria. But it's one of those things where the public, I think, would probably support it because they would believe that these people are all sexual predators who are extremely dangerous. They would not know that people who are being committed are sometimes not that dangerous. As far as I know, we have not unearthed any violence, but yet they're deeming him a violent predator. There's something intellectually dishonest about calling someone a violent predator when they have not engaged in any violence.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's funny you say that. And I'm thinking about this particular situation with him sending some inappropriate text messages. There's way more to this story than we're ever going to go into. But a friend of mine here in town, he served 5 years for intimidating a witness by text message because he was deemed a threat by text message.
Well, I suppose depending on what he said in the text message, but
it wasn't all that. At least by his assertion. I haven't read the case or anything like that. I'm just going by his word. But
Paul Manafort sitting in prison now for intimidated witness also.
That's true. That's true. And we don't even know what he said. That's true. But I mean, he has a cell phone and he has a laptop.
But I bet he's not calling the witnesses on that cell phone.
That's true. Do you think that the treatment providers in these places, if you were like the do-gooder and you're like, I'm going to try and get people out of here. And you start writing reports saying, inmate one, I think that they're not a threat and they can go home. Do you think then the warden or whoever's supervising these things, do you think that they would then shuttle those people out to get people in there that would fit their agenda and keeping people in? Did I word that right?
I like the way you worded it. And I'm sorry to say, I believe that that probably happens. I have never known in my life, and I'm spanning six decades now, I've never known of an entity that wants to go out of business. And I would be surprised if the civil commitment people were sitting around saying, gee, how on earth can we figure out how to get this damn place shut down? I would be very surprised. A police don't do that. When crime goes down, they don't say, gee, let's go tell city council crime's down by 34%. We need to take a third reduction in our force. I would bet that if there are such people in these facilities saying that these folks don't belong here, I would suspect they're meeting with some resistance in terms of trying to get those people out of there. I just don't think that would be the reaction of folks. Do you know anybody that wants to eliminate their own job?
Well, I was just going to say, it seems like we as a public would be in our interest to enact policies that would bring crime down to zero. If, you know, we're never going to achieve it, obviously, but that we should do everything in our power to reduce crime at every angle that we can. It doesn't seem like we're doing it that way. And same thing here. We are not doing anything to try and if what treatment can be provided to people in civil commitment to help them get better to where they can be released out on the street, because it's got to be cheaper than paying $90,000. And that's just that one state. I did see someone posted something out there. States cost $150,000 a year to keep them locked up this way. I mean, the prices range wildly.
I think it was even more in Minnesota, but the goal of traditional civil commitment, when we get outside the sex offender realm, the goal is to release some, like what eventually happened with John Hinckley, the attempted Reagan assassin. There'll be a lot of youngsters that don't know who we're talking about, but the goal was to rehabilitate Hinckley and release him. I could swallow civil commitment a little bit more, the sex offender specific, if they had treated the person for mental illness all through the process and acknowledge at the front end that this person has a mental illness. And at the end of their prison sentence, if the mental health treatment had not worked and they needed more treatment, I could possibly go along with committing them. But the goal should be to release them, to rehabilitate them and release them. If that's not the goal, then it's really not civil commitment. It's a disguised a permanent incarceration.
Yeah, it's a disguised life in prison scheme.
And I think in Minnesota, practically no one has gotten out. Maybe mm-hmm. a handful of people now since the court got involved. But it's all intellectually dishonest, because they treat you as a criminal only until the court's jurisdiction runs out and you're going to walk out, and then magically you have a mental disorder.
Yeah. That isn't necessarily listed in the DSM.
Correct, because it's mental abnormality. But even with traditional civil commitment, like with Hinckley, now there are a lot of young listeners who won't remember the trial where he was put on trial, and they tried to convict him of the attempted assassination of the president and the other individuals, and the government, when that defense was asserted, they said there wasn't anything wrong with him. He knew exactly what he was doing. But when the jury returned the verdict of not guilty by reason of insanity, the government magically flip-flopped. All of a sudden, Hinckley became very, very sick. So when they got to the civil commitment hearing, what they had argued in the criminal trial was thrown completely out the window, and they said he was a very sick man. And they continued to argue that through the decades that he was confined. They said how sick he was. And in fact, they even knew that he had a romantic relationship, because he was getting some passes away from St. Elizabeth. And they argued that since he had a breakup with that woman, that he was still suffering from the trauma of the breakup, and that he would not be suitable for release until he got enough treatment over. Now, when has the government been so concerned about trauma that you suffered from a breakup? So there's intellectually dishonest to go around. But now Hinckley did just the opposite. He argued in his criminal trial that he was very sick. Mm-hmm. And then when he got to the civil side, he argued that he was quite well. He magically got better. And he said, I don't need any special commitment here. I'm ready to go home. Of course, they didn't buy into that, and nobody thought they would. But your arguments flip flop depending on where you are, which side of the issue you're on. Hinckley magically thought he wasn't sick, and the government magically thought he was, after they couldn't put him in prison.
Yeah, I understand. Is there anything else you want to cover on civil commitment? I think I've exhausted my battery of questions.
Oh, I think that we could do another day sometime, but it's a very important issue because people are really being deprived of reasonable due process, and they're being locked up on minuscule evidence, and that's wrong. That's not the America that I want to live in, where we do this kind of thing to people. And civil commitment is just something where it's constitutional to commit people. The courts have repeatedly said that. But we've got to make the process as difficult as possible, and we've got to make it as robust as possible for the review process as they come up for review to make sure that they get a fair shot at being released. But I'd prefer that people be treated on the front end rather than after they've done their prison time. If they really have a mental issue, that's the time to deal with it.
Well, Larry, since last time we went out of the show with on a negative note and got some negative feedback on the negative message, can you come up with something positive?
Well, what was the negative? Oh, it was because I didn't think something was going to change in my lifetime.
That was it. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anything positive?
Well, there's positive in that we're winning lawsuits around the country. The courts are taking us seriously. We've got some very important cases pending. 10th Circuit. We're going to talk about that this coming week on Arsenal in Action.
Oh yeah, tell us about the call Wednesday. This podcast will go out Monday night, so they'll have about 36 hours before the Wednesday night call to get ready.
Well, a component of the challengers in the case called Millard v. Rankin, which is in the 10th Circuit now, one of the plaintiffs, Vega, his name was Leroy Vega, I believe, may have the first name wrong, but Vega had a complaint about the removal process in Colorado about how haphazard when you've been on the registry, you can petition to deregister. And the unclear standards for the judges could invent them as they go along. And Judge Mache, who was the district judge that found that was one component of his findings, that the removal process was seriously flawed because he tried twice and was denied. And so we're going to have an attorney named Colleen Kelly from, what's the name of that law firm?
Wolf Law.
We're going to have, and she's done a number of deregistration petitions. So we're going to be talking about, we're going to bring those issues together. But this case, Narsil did an amicus brief where we're urging that the 10th Circuit uphold the trial judge's findings that the statutory scheme on registration in Colorado is unconstitutional and force those people to have to go back and do some work to come up with a more constitutional statute. So we're going to talk about the 10th Circuit case and deregistration. I suspect most of the interest will be in deregistration because what people are going to want to know is, can I move to Colorado if I'm anywhere in the vicinity and get off the registry? And then they're going to want to know, can they move back home to where they were once they get off? So we'll talk about things like that.
Got it. And you said Colleen Kelly, so she's an attorney from Colorado that's going to join in on the call. And that's all I got.
Well, thanks, Andy. And how can people get in touch with us if they have anything positive or negative or any constructive additions we can do on a future
I want to throw this out. I want to make a request. I want to ask people to help me track down, I don't even know what the word would be, but little segment blockers. I'm not sure if I'm going to try and bring the podcast up to this level of work. I mean, I already spend a bunch of hours, but so say we're going to cover something about the Constitution. There have been TV shows or movie quotes that would be a 3-4-5 second block that would be something I could throw in between these segments. You know, I can't imagine a movie where they've talked about civil commitment unless it was a movie like Sling Blade. But if you know of those, there's too much stuff out there for me to watch, maybe on Law and Order Special Victims Unit, which is the worst show on television, but things like that. Send them in, give me a YouTube link with the timestamp of where you're looking at. That would be awesome. And I might try and increase the production quality here. But to your question, how can they reach out to us? The website is registrymatters.co. You can leave feedback there or get other contact. All the links to all of the places you can find the podcast are there. And we love to have voicemail questions come in, and you can do 747-227-4477. And the email address is registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And lastly, if you want to support the show directly, it would be awesome. We appreciate it. And that is patreon.com/registrymatters.
Well, thank you, Andy. And I look forward to seeing you Wednesday night on Narsil in action.
Yep. Thank you very much, Larry. I appreciate it as always.
So good night.
Good night.